Successful people learn how to make their mind work for them. I'm David Nagel, and this is the Successful Mind Podcast. Hey, everybody, this is David Nagel, and welcome to the Successful Mind Podcast. Today, we are in New York at VaynerMedia, and we have our special guest, Gary Vaynerchuk. Gary, thank you so much for doing this.
Really excited to be here.
I'm very excited to talk to you about this because you talk about something, self-awareness, right? You say self-awareness is the key.
Yes.
And my number one question for you is, how did you become self-aware? Like, when did that happen for you? When did it all click in? You're like, this is who I am. This is what I'm here to do. And then you were like, nose to the grindstone with it.
In some way, when I hear that question, what feels natural to me is a evolution between 11 and 18. Somewhere between definitely fourth grade, when I had the conviction and the guts to have weird little conversations with myself in bed when I would be anxious about the fact that I was making this transition to being a bad student. I don't know how else to say it. Like, you know, in third grade, I got straight A's and would win in flashcards because I have good math skills. And in fourth grade, I literally started getting bad grades. And A, it didn't come natural to me anymore. Like now I think my mind was wandering in class. So the ability to just listen and go off of that to be successful became a problem, because now I was already starting to think about how to sell baseball cards to my friends. What am I going to do after school? Let me make a joke to make everybody laugh. My brain started to wander. And then it was also around the time when it was time to actually do stuff at home, like homework. And that was unacceptable because I had to play Nerf football and try to sell and video games. And so between that moment and even right up to senior year of high school, navigating that and understanding, like, this is what I'm good at, this is what I'm not good at. And then really in high school, intuitively, subconsciously, naturally, being able to not have to fit in and not being affected by, I mean, look, it's really interesting. I think anybody who's listening, I mean, maybe this is a Jersey thing, but like, everybody made fun of everybody all the time, always. That was just the nature of it. Yeah, right? You know, I think a lot about what are we doing to children in our parenting now that make it so difficult? You know, and extreme bullying is very different than getting made fun of occasionally. And so there's a lot of variables to this. But, you know, the high school years of like not worrying about my popularity and valuing, one of the things that I'm most proud of is getting DMs and messages from high school friends today saying, man, this is so cool because this was always actually you. You literally had the, like, things verbatim. You had the guts to be friends with everybody in high school. And I was very proud of that. I was very proud of weirdest kid on the bus.
So you didn't try to fit in. You were...
I thought fitting in was fitting in with everybody.
Okay.
Instead of fitting in to like six people. So I wanted to fit in with the kid that nobody was nice to. I wanted to fit into the kids that were naturally kind of my core friends who were like into sports or sports cards.
Yeah.
I wanted to fit in with popular kids, and that was easy too. You know, I am who I am. Obviously, I have people skills. But yeah, I was aware that it was unusual how I was navigating through high school, not going to parties, but working, being friends with the weird kids, you know, not over pandering to the coolest kids in our school, not being good at grades. Like I was an enigma my whole life. And I think 11 to 18 was when that manifested. And that's a long-winded answer to, that's when I started understanding myself, which is what I would argue self-awareness was. It was also when I went through, wait a minute, I'm not the cutest kid in class. Wait a minute, I'm not the best athlete. Because in second and fourth, fifth grade, in fourth grade, I thought I was the best looking, most athletic kid in my class. And very honestly, I think there's a chance I was. But
that's because your mom was pumping you up. Like
100%.
She was like positive
and,
all the way.
I was like, you know, I was, yes, that. And I was competitive and I have great hand-eye coordination and I matured slowly. So I had boyish looks. Like, yes, all those things. But it was I was not scared of all the bad stuff. And I think we live in a world right now where people are scared of the bad stuff.
Tremendously.
And I believe that that's what leads to delusion. You don't want to face that you're not the fastest, you're not the best looking, you're not the smartest. You don't want to face that. You don't accept that, which leads to a lack of self-awareness.
So I'm kind of guessing that you were a sensitive kid. Like I hear you,
yes.
you cried a lot. You got your feelings hurt.
By the way, I'm going to give you a huge dap. That is the first time that somebody has said that. And it couldn't be more true. Yeah. I cried constantly from 1982 to 1988. And I mean multiple times a week. Real crying.
Well, that brings me to another question. So you talked about when you went to work with your dad.
Yes.
And he kind of sensed your bullshit, right?
Yes.
Like you could really bullshit people, right?
Right.
And you made a comment on one of your podcasts that there were many times you were in his office crying.
Yes.
What was he doing?
You know what's funny? Him saying to me, like, you know, the number's the number, or like, he never really, my dad doesn't talk a lot. So he was a man from the old school. So
yeah.
It wasn't like he sat me down and said, son, you know, this embellishing or lying is it wasn't like that. It would be like, you know, a customer would walk in and they're like, I would try to sell them a bottle of wine. And I was, you want to talk about not being self-aware? The audacity that I had as a 14-year-old who looked 9 to have a grown-up come into a liquor store, hand them the bottle of wine that I knew we had to sell and be like, you should buy this. And they would look at me and say, well, have you had it? And I would say yes with a straight fucking face and really like believed it. Like, yeah. Is pretty ludicrous. And what would happen is he would give me a look and I could sense like, oh, I did something wrong, not right, even though I accomplished the goal. And very quickly it came out, it started chipping away. The reason I would cry is my dad is tough. You know, I would be a 15-year-old kid. I would work 11 hours, like from 7, we'd leave the house at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
The store, you know, got there at 8:10. My dad would do the deposit. I'd have to keep myself busy. The store opened at 9. It's now 7 p.m. No lunch break. I've worked every minute. This is like child fucking hardcore real labor. And then at like 6:50, I would go to my dad and muster up the guts to be like, hey, dad, are we going home soon? And he would like bark at me. Like, you know, like that made me cry. Like, I don't know.
Right,
like it was like sad. Like I was like, fucking like, fuck, this is hard.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the truth is actually I'm embellishing a little bit there. Not that would upset me. What made me cry actually is my dad genuinely did not treat employees well. And I'm sensitive to it as I'm saying it right now.
Yeah.
He transformed in the way that he changed my ability to lie. I changed his point of view on employees.
Yeah.
He just wasn't nice. You know, I'd watch people really work. He came from the Soviet Union.
Right.
You know, he looked at employees like not the way, like genuinely the complete opposite of the way I look at employees.
Well, you're,
like I look at these guys, like I look at them.
Yeah.
And I just know what I feel. And I feel a sense of responsibility. And my dad genuinely felt like I'm paying you and fucking work. Like, fuck you. Like, really. And that really bothered me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the guy was working for his fucking life. I mean, what a break to get out of the Soviet Union, be able to come here and do what he did.
I judged him immensely at the time.
Yeah.
Look, there's people that have come from hard places that don't treat their employees like shit.
Right.
So I still judge it at some level. I understand it a lot more. He really feared, was crippled by the notion of people stealing from him. Crippled.
Did that happen a lot in the Soviet Union? Was that a deal?
Like, oh, so I don't know if you know this. This is one of the most fascinating things to talk to Americans about. I don't think Americans actually really genuinely understand socialism or communism.
I would agree.
Because they can't. I don't blame.
Right.
Everything was stolen.
Everything was stolen.
The government owns everything. So imagine every store and every company is owned by the government. So I, Gary, don't own Vayner. I'm some general manager of. Not compensated in any way based on its success. So now I'm making a deal with Dustin that he can come in at night and steal the computers and sell them on the black market.
Oh,
but
no
kick
shit.
Me some cash. Everything was stolen. The entire country ran on the black market.
Yeah.
Think about what's illegal in America. Drugs, black market. Guns at some level, yeah. Certain type. But everything that's illegal here is on the black market.
And everything is over there.
Everything. Milk and tile and carpet and chairs. And like, it took, you know, people waited 13 years. My parents waited 13 years to get a phone. And like 20 years to get on the line for a refrigerator. And 15 for a car. And like, you waited 7 hours in line for bread. Like, the when I talk about utter ridiculousness of entitlement in America in its current state, $7 coffees, you know, complaining about Delta being late by 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I not only come from a kid that grew up in America in a very immigrant household that never bought anything for anybody about anything. I also come as the byproduct of parents and stories my entire childhood of ludicrous shit that not a person here can understand.
Right.
Not here in this room, not anybody who's listening. Go wait 7 hours in line for a piece of bread.
Yeah.
And have access to no other food. Go, show me. Show me how much you're going to cry about not getting as many likes on Instagram posts.
Well, I mean, there's this huge breeding of entitlement that is going on in the country that is...
It's called prosperity. It's why empires fall.
Yeah.
Rome did it. Genghis Khan did it. We're doing it.
Yeah.
We are going to lose. China already won. This is just watching it play out.
Right.
Like, this is over. Every little Chinese kid is way more hungrier than our little fuckers. And guess what? I say good. I don't want it to be. This is my team. This is the jersey I'm wearing.
Do you think we rebound from it?
No.
You don't think
Europe hasn't rebounded from it. We beat the fuck out of them.
True.
No, there's no rebounding. Because it's the progression of the game. The young, hungrier thing wins, and the fatter, older thing loses. We're the fatter, older thing. We think somebody owes us shit.
Yeah.
For what? Why? I love it. I love losing. I love the process. I love merit. That's why I love losing. I do believe that some kid in the suburb of China who is a single child because of population control and has parents driving the shit out of them to make it. And of course, that has all its own shortcomings too. We all know what our grandparents did to our parents. I get it. The question is, which one's better? We're very good at sitting in our collective ivory towers in America, judging, you know, our parents' generation, and it was tough, and beating a kid and hitting and all this. Ha 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 ha. Guess what? We're about to fucking lose.
They don't think that they can.
What's worse, spanking your kid or creating such delusion that they're depressed for the rest of their fucking life?
Right.
I don't know. I'm going to hit a kid instead.
And
of course, everything's a balance. But like, you know, there's a balance between beating the fuck out of your child.
Right.
For real, like the extreme terrible things that happen in our society. And what my mom did, which was smack me in the face when I got out of hand, which said, fuck, I'm not going to do that again. I don't want to get punched again.
What do you think?
And it wasn't punch. It was an open hand slap. Yeah. But it fucking hurt.
Where did your mom's positivity come from?
Her natural DNA. She lost her mother at 5. Her dad went to jail when she was 8 for 10 years. She fucking lived in the Soviet Union. It definitely didn't come from her environment.
That's interesting. Well, like we were saying before, like there's a lot of people that grow up in different environments, but their attitude, how that plays out in their life.
By the way, for the record, and I love co-signing my parents, perfectly parented, all that shit.
Yeah.
And my mom crushed it all time. I've mentioned it 8 billion times. I promise you, with the natural DNA that I was given, if I was born under a fucking rock in like fucking a shitty town in Turkey to like some shit, I'd fucking be here. Probably with a little bit more fucked up shit and a little bit less love to give, but I'd be here because I'm optimistic.
Here's one of the things that I find that's really interesting. You talk about you have this natural DNA, right? That you, like your success is wrapped up in your DNA. And one of the things that I do is I help people become, that want to become successful, really successful. So we work on their mindset. We help them build out the company that they're building, whatever. But what's fascinating about it is you can't instill the want in a person to do it. So you have people be like, hey, I want to do this. And then they don't do anything. And then you have other individuals, they want it and they'll do anything that is necessary
to get there. There's a huge division between people that want for stuff and people who want for process.
Totally.
And I think one of the things I'm trying to figure out is in the framework that you set that up, this is why I want to change success. you're properly, because of the way we all came up, deeming, you're creating a system, I assume, I'm making some assumptions here, that a level of, you know, the framework creates success financially, because that's the nature of a business, like, right? I believe that there's a real atomic bomb that I can drop on society over the next 50 years around actually reframing success, which will then lead to everybody having the chance to love a process. There's a lot of people who have the natural DNA to be an all-time stay-at-home dad. But because we haven't created the framework yet to making a stay-at-home dad who crushes and raises three children that go on to do incredible things as an incredible North Star of being successful, in the same way that we do a billionaire or an NBA, you know, champion or a rapper that wins a Grammy, we have not given macro permission yet for the people to self. I mean, I know employees right now that work for me, men, and I know their wives, that they should be doing reversal. That the man should stay at home and do the nurturing, and the mom's the fucking shark, and she's not happy and he's not happy. And the only reason they're doing it is we have not had a mature enough conversation around success. We have created so many, by the way, we talk, thank God, we talk so much more now about women and minorities and their thing, but like, and you know, a guy who deep in his soul thinks he's a nurturing father and wants to stay home is frowned upon by his contemporaries, friends, and society. You know, immediately goes into old school people thinking he's a loser and he can't provide and he's balking out, yet he would love that process. There are absolutely people who do not love the process of building a business that makes money. And thus they will stop and start and have micro wins and macro failures and will never achieve it.
It is, if a person comes to us and they want to work with us, that's one of the first questions that we ask them is, do they actually love the process of what they do? Because if they don't, they'll fail. If they're just going after the car or their house or, you know, the jet or whatever it is, it's like, no, you're not, it won't happen. You will fail.
And I think eventually there'll be more businesses built on, you know, bailing them out. You know, I have to be empathetic to what you have upfront opportunity costs and other things. Like, I think there's a way, I think there's a lot of good stuff on the horizon. I think, I genuinely believe your business, you exact human beings, 40 years from now, as things get reframed, the business was built from day one to be able to afford to kick Dustin out a week in when you just decided no way. Whereas I'm just, and I, maybe that is what you do, but I would never expect the business to do that. I do believe that we need to reframe success. We have to make happy. We have to, for the fucking sake of so many fucking millions of people, we have to make success happiness. We have to. We have to teach people how to live very happily, making $81,000 a year, that is controlling their expenses, that is not applying for credit cards, that is not valuing the clothes they wear and the cars they drive. We have to teach parents how to make their children feel comfortable that they have a worse car or, you know, things. Like, we have to teach that as an advantage. Like, kids are funny. Like, I think you can educate kids at 7 or 8 of like, hey, we have less, that is going to be your advantage. I believed it, and so others can too.
Right.
We've just become very consumeristic. We've become very at the mercy of opinion. Judgment is at an all-time high. People are just judging people left and right now because of the political climate.
And they're crashing because of it.
Like, I don't think we've even seen the crash. We are in a opioid and mental health crisis, and the economy is phenomenal.
Right.
Does everybody understand what's about to happen next? Do you understand that only financial success is holding up many as a last leg? And when that goes, I genuinely believe the mental carnage that comes with the next economic downturn is going to be far more extreme than we can predict, because the overlay of depression is far greater than it was in 1987, in 1998, in 2008, in 2001, post 9/11, and the dot-com bubble, and all the other times it's happened. I'm very, very, very concerned, and hence my actions speak to that. My content has taken a fundamental shift over the last 2 to 3 years because I want to put my head on the pillow when this all goes down to say, I gave it my best at bat. Very few people on earth have spent the dollars and time to create a communication infrastructure to pump positivity with practicality at scale to the level that I have on fucking earth.
I don't know anybody.
and so I need to do that because I believe I see what's about to happen and I can't look the other way and look myself in the mirror when it actually goes down, when I know I have it in me to be the kind of communicator that can make a positive impact.
Right.
And if four, by the way, I actually said this yesterday to Phil Toronto over dinner, my friend and business associate. I said, I never thought about it. And this is probably why I just said what I just said, because how the subconscious works. I have a funny feeling that Gary V consumers, people that consume my content, are going to be major winners during the next downturn because they're going to believe, like I do, that this adversity is good. They're going to enjoy going back to Rocky and moving in with their parents and all this. They're going to put the process of the rebuilding on a pedestal, while the far majority that haven't consumed this perspective are going to think it's the worst thing that ever happened.
Well, it's because it's built on a false narrative.
I agree.
They blew something that's absolutely not true. That's never going to go away.
I agree.
Okay, we have a question. So we're giving away a case of empathy wine.
Thank you.
To one of our listeners.
Okay.
Her name is Chef Lizette. And this was it. This is
what, I've heard of Chef Lizette.
Yes. Okay.
Who has interacted with every single piece of content of mine over the last 8 years.
Okay. So, well, maybe you've heard this before. So she said, you stated so smartly on a sports podcast with Adam Schein.
Okay.
That you believe the metrics for vetting incoming football players should be based more on emotional intelligence versus bench press or performance stats. What should the metrics or standards be for putting social media influencers on a pedestal?
What was the transition she just made?
What should the metrics be or standards for putting social media influencers on a pedestal?
Well, definitely should not be following count. And that is what we currently score on.
Right.
You know, I think where Chef Lizette is going properly is I believe in the gray, not in the black and white. And the point I was making on Shiny's podcast was, now that I've been in the football business for 3 years, I'm like, whoa, right. This, you know, maybe because football is my one weird place. Yeah. I never deployed my thought on the world on football, but now I have, which is, oh, right. Football's just like everything I believe in. I don't care that you went to Harvard and you're good at sales. If you're a piece of shit, you're not going to be good in my company because you're going to destroy everything around you.
Yeah.
That's football. I don't give a fuck if you run a 3.940, if you're beating women, if you fucking hang out with fucking pieces of shit, if you're an insecure dick in the locker room and nobody likes you, I don't care how many fucking touchdowns you're going to score. Inevitably, that is going to be a problem. And I now have gone through 3 drafts where I've recruited these kids. When we recruit kids, I get data, you know, AJ and the team's recruiting, I get data. They're looking at stuff like, we know who their girlfriend is. We know who their boyfriend is. We know, you know, their parent situation. We know who they hang out with. We know how they roll. I'm super scared to, as you can imagine, in my position, Vayner Sports will never make enough money, let alone happiness, to offset me taking somebody who then goes and does something outrageously egregious, and then I have to deal with the brand, you know, I don't even know how to answer to the world, you know, if Aaron Hernandez had been, you know, repped by Vayner's. I don't even know how to, I don't even know what I would do. I mean, I know what I would do. I'd go live stream and be like, take full responsibility. I should have saw it, but like, you don't control people. No matter how much I bet, I'm still not going to control people. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of thought that goes into who we recruit on Vayner Sports, not just where we think they're getting drafted. Since I've gone through that, I have seen people that have been complete no's to me. No chance. We will not recruit them. Go in the top 30 picks in the NFL draft, and 3 years later, already not be in a good spot. AKA out of the fucking league, which is unheard of. Like, on a practice squad, not playing, you know, just, you know, so, that's what we need to do with social media influencers or anybody else. I believe over time we will get far more thoughtful around emotional intelligence. And I do believe that, look, I think I'm a living proof of it. My level of fame, whatever it is growing rapidly. And it is not because I'm so attractive or so funny or so incredible in my athletics. I am bringing value to human beings, which results in admiration. There are really fancy people that I have dinners with, handlers at events that handle way more famous people than me, and they are constantly taken aback by the interactions I have with people who stop me in the halls, at the airport, in life, and to the point where somewhere inevitably, by the third interaction, if I take three selfies or have two conversations, they will literally, and again, these are people who are surrounded by the most famous people in the world, they will look at me and say, what's going on? And I do not believe they're saying, I didn't realize how many people knew you. I think what they're saying is, why does this feel different? And I believe that admiration feels different than liking somebody for something vain.
Yeah.
And I believe that that will be scored long-term, impact and how you make people feel, and like, you know, the quality of what you're putting out into the world will continue to rise.
I think subconsciously people know the truth. Like, you, it resonates with a person when they hear it, and you're everywhere with that truth that you so passionately believe in, and it just resonates with the soul.
I think that's right. And that's why the other thing that people ask me about when I'm in, again, I'm traveling enough and doing enough events that people inevitably will be with me for the day, the partners of the event or what have you, and they're completely flabbergasted by the demo range. You know, a lot of people think my audience is like young dudes, and then we'll be walking in the airport or at the event and a 73-year-old African-American female will roll up and a 55-year-old old white guy or like, you know, Latino, you know, 9-year-old from TikTok. Like,
yeah.
It's, the truth is universal.
Okay. Okay. So it is. And that brings me to my next question. It comes from Liv. My sales manager's daughter watches you on TikTok.
Yes.
And she heard that I was interviewing you. And she said to me the other night at a party, she's
How
like,
how old is she?
Ten. She's 10. Okay. She said, would you ask Gary a question for me? And I said, sure. What is it? So she had two questions. One, why do you make videos? And two, what is your favorite food?
I love it.
Right?
This growth in the under 12 demo is going to be a lot of fun. You get a lot of favorite food. Favorite food is definitely English peas. So not snap peas, not, you know, not green beans. There's something called English peas.
Yep.
They are my complete obsession. I love them. When they're in season, I'm like the happiest boy. Why do I make videos?
Yes.
I have an inherent want to share goodness that I feel uncomfortably grateful and almost borderline guilty in having in my body. I used to hear things like, I have to, or it, you know, my body's making me, you know, and I would like, you know, and I would always like laugh and think that was such horseshit, like an, you know, like from a musician or, you know, an actor or actress. I understand now. I had no interest in anything remotely close to notoriety or fame. I was 34 years old before I'm, 30, excuse me, I was 31 years old before I made a wine video, and I was 34 years old before I made a business video. I didn't move to LA and wait tables to be on television. Right. I worked in a liquor store in New Jersey.
And that's where you did the video, was in the liquor store.
I mean, and this is where I do mine now. Like, this is not, it's not super complicated. The world changed and gave me opportunity to communicate, and I needed to do it. I had to do it. It felt right. What I was doing for my inner circle and for my acquaintances, I now had an opportunity to do at scale. And the admiration is intoxicating. The attention is cool. I'm okay with it. Yeah. But I'm not in love. I didn't, if I was in need of the attention, I would have gone for fame as a child.
Right.
The admiration is intoxicating. I genuinely enjoy being admired. And I don't even know if that's like good or like kind of like super, not like weirdly selfish and kind of like, you know, narcissist.
No,
I don't think so, but I'm okay. Punchline is I'm okay saying, I've never really heard anybody say it. So I almost don't know where it sits when people hear me say I'm addicted to admiration. I see it as good. It means I'm being held accountable to doing good things because I can't be admired for making the most money.
As long as you don't get high on it, right? As long as it doesn't.
I've gotten more sober on it. As I continue to gain momentum, I find myself going the other way. I find myself trying to scrutinize myself more. I find myself trying to share more of my shortcomings or inabilities. I find myself overreacting to making sure I say hello to everybody or be thoughtful of every interaction.
Yeah.
I find myself speaking to myself more, saying, fuck are you? Like, do you understand that you can die in an hour and nobody's going to give a fuck in a week outside of like 7 to 12 of your family members? And then your inner circle a little bit, maybe you get a month out of them, but what? Like the amount of times I say to myself, who the fuck are you? Do you understand that if you died right now, nobody's going to give a fuck is very high. And I love that. I don't think that's dark. I think that is that's a counterbalance conversation with myself that is reacting to there's a lot going on with me right now and I'm aware of it, but I don't think that makes me special. I really don't. I think it makes my parents special. I think it makes my circumstance special.
Right.
I feel like I'm just I feel like I'm a FedEx box. I'm like just the thing that's just delivering it. Like I'm just the container.
Yeah.
Really, I mean it. VaynerMedia's success, I feel good about. I'm the architect. But I feel like I'm the product. I'm the Pinocchio. I was made.
Yeah.
And so it's hard for me when you're like, you're great. I'm like, fuck, man. I wish I made me instead of being me.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's why, actually, this is funny. That's why me, Gary Vaynerchuk, the human strategist, is much more proud about what's happening with me than the person that gets the attention. Like the person, me behind me, as I think about how and what I do, like, because I set the strategy. That I'm actually really proud of. Not that people are like, you're so awesome.
Right. So if you're coming from that place, I ask everybody to leave our audience with one successful mind tip. Given that you feel like you're just a channel for that, that your parents made you, what would you recommend to everybody that's listening is something that they could do from a thinking perspective?
Practical optimism.
Practical optimism.
It's pulling from the opposite directions. This is why left and right in America are getting torn apart. They're both right in different ways. There is absolutely no room for being cruel or mean or suppressive to another human being. Period.
Agreed.
There's also a very dangerous slope when you eliminate merit and accountability. It leads to entitlement and delusion, which leads to depression. So fuck your eighth place trophies, Brooklyn, right? But fuck you if you're fucking, you think you're better than somebody because they don't look like you.
Yeah.
Like you're not from here. Fuck you. No cruelty and no delusional. Practical optimism. You don't work, it's highly likely the thing you don't want to, the thing you want to happen will not happen. Like, so, but be optimistic. Like, you know, optimism really matters. Like, the internet is the playground, not the government, not America, not your parents, not schools, not your job. We all have unlimited, we have levels of freedom that have never been seen before.
Sure.
I mean, you can create an avatar character. If you think you're so suppressed, create a cartoon. Make an old white man if he's got it so good. By the way, that's another thing that people need to understand. The level of depression in white males is just as high as everybody else.
Right.
Like this, privilege is mindset, not what you look like. Like, you know, like the mindset game, we can see what we all look like.
Yeah.
And so we can make judgment, and that's fine. I'm not gonna be able to change that. But if you want to have a more thoughtful conversation, what's going on in people's chemicals in their brain is far more privileged than anything else. There are people making $32,000 a year, are a super minority of minorities within this country, and are fucking skipping and whistling to happiness every day.
Agreed.
And there's fucking a 41-year-old white dude with a fucking Benzo and a Ferrari and a Lamborghini and a private plane and making $33 million a year. Who's fucking doing drugs at night just to cope with the deep inherent pain in his heart. That's the truth.
That's true.
And so, you know, we got a lot of work to do, but I always think that times like this lead to the bounce back. I think we're on the verge of a tremendous era in our society that is going to be the reaction to a lot of what's going on right now, all the tension in the air. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to in my mid-50s through 60s to watch our society prosper in its real efforts to do more of the right collective thing. And I think that will only happen once we have empathy and compassion to listen instead of just yelling at each other and judging and everyone sucks.
Yeah. Awesome. Gary, thanks much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Thanks for listening to the Successful Mind Podcast. And if you like what you heard and you want to know more, go to davidnagel.com/freestuff.